Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Today we are spending the hour with the nation's John Nichols. He's out with a new book called The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party, The Enduring Legacy of Henry Wallace's Anti-Fascist, Anti-Racist Politics. John Nichols writes that the Democratic Party has abandoned its visionary past to become the managerial party of Bill Clinton and the surrender caucus that shows up whenever the party is in a position to prevail. But he says it goes beyond Clinton and corporate Democrats. He traced the roots of the decay of a party that couldn't beat Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, both George Bushes, or Donald Trump. And the closer he got to the last days of Franklin Roosevelt's presidency, he writes, "The more I focused on that definitional fight, the clearer it became that the lost soul of the Democratic Party was a man, and his name was Henry Wallace." 75 years ago, Henry Wallace, the then Vice President of the United States, mounted a campaign against the danger of American fascism. He warned that if the New Deal was not expanded, American fascists would use fear-mongering, xenophobia, and racism to regain the economic and political power they lost. His vision and standing in the Democratic Party were quickly sidelined. John Nichols is National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation, and the author of many, many books. His latest is called The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party. Hi, John. Welcome back to the show.
Rose, what an honor to be with you.
Well, it's always great to have you, John. Before we dive in and talk about your book, I just want to talk with you and get your thoughts about COVID. I know that this is not really your area, but I feel like we have to just keep bringing this up because, you know, we're only 4 months away from the presidential election. And it's unclear if people are going to be able to physically show up to vote. Yesterday, the U.S. set another record with over 62,000 cases. Infections are on the rise in 30 states. Wisconsin actually hit a record yesterday.
No, you're right. And, well, you know, I think COVID is all of our areas, right? I mean, it's the reality that will change our futures for better or worse. And so we all have to have a focus on it. So I'm glad you asked. I've been writing a lot recently about these election issues and these questions of what will happen if we have a massive resurgence of coronavirus in the fall, say in October, leading into the November election. What will that mean? Are we prepared? What steps should be taken, et cetera? And the answer to the first question, are we prepared, is no. We are massively unprepared for a COVID-19 election. And that's been well established. We know that there have been chaotic and difficult and dysfunctional primaries, including one in my own state of Wisconsin, but also one in Georgia, troublesome situation in Kentucky. We know that even though there's relatively high turnout, because a lot of people are accessing absentee voting or mail-in voting in different forms, that many people are still disenfranchised because they're forced into a situation where they have to make a choice between following public health orders that tell them to socially distance, stay at home, you know, try and do everything they can to avoid spreading the virus and also contacting it themselves. And we know that on the one side that is there, and the other side is their duty as citizens, their desire as Americans to participate in democracy and to make real the promise of representative democracy. So we've got a real problem here, and we are already way too late when it comes to preparing for the November election. What we should be doing, unquestionably, is pass the HEROES Act, which is sitting in the Senate, you know, with Mitch McConnell not taking it up, for a variety of reasons. It bails out state, local government, as well as schools, and does a lot of other important things. But within that HEROES Act is about $4 billion in funding for making a functional election. I've interviewed Stacey Abrams, other folks, about, you know, what you need to do. And they all come back to the same basic premises, that you have to maximize mail-in voting, maximize absentee voting, establish the most effective early voting methods, and make sure that for those who do choose to vote on election day, that you have the safest and most sanitary and appropriate settings in which to do that. The $4 billion that's in the HEROES Act could close the gap in a lot of ways, in a lot of places. But the other part of the HEROES Act that's really important is a substantial amount of funding for the Postal Service, because remember, people aren't even thinking about the prospect that the Postal Service could hit serious financial problems early in the fall. And if you combine a sputtering Postal Service with a COVID-19 election, you end up in a situation where even if people do try to do mail voting, it could become very dysfunctional. So we should have the red alarms flashing. We should be scared. But we should put our fear aside and get urgent about making sure that we make the interventions at the local, state, and federal level to have a free and fair and safe election.
To add to some of the problems you listed, CNN has a report about staffing. So many retirees were volunteers, but they're choosing to stay home because they're at greater risk from COVID. So a major problem is in Wisconsin, Georgia, Kentucky, elsewhere, is finding new poll workers to work at the precincts. The other major, major problem, and this really deserves more attention in the media, some states are not going to count the ballots until the polls close. This could mean that we might not have a winner for days or weeks, which could lead to a very ugly legal battle.
You're totally right about all of this. And this is why, again, we need to get the funding and the resources in, particularly to make mail voting work. That's why you have that delay in the counting of the ballots. And it's an appropriate thing, because people should be able to mail their ballots until, you know, the time the polls close. If they can't physically get to the polling place, they should be able to on up to and including that election day, mail their ballots in. By the nature of that, though, that means that the ballots won't be physically in hand for election officials for 2, 3, 4, 5, even 6 days. We're simply going to have a week there of uncertainty, I think. That's problematic. It's challenging. But the primary problem there is for our media. Our media has become obsessed with the idea of declaring the winner at 8:01 when 26 precincts have been counted. And they don't have to do that. What they should be doing is educating people that we're going to have a safe, fair, and functional election, that part of that is that ballots will be cast and counted, and that it's going to take some time to do that. It's fine to do that a week later in November. We can still hit all the marks as regards the Electoral College, which, by the way, shouldn't exist, and ultimately the inauguration of a president. Even if there's legal battles or legal wrangling, we should be able to do that. But the problem, Rose, is that if we don't have sufficient planning and education in advance, and if we don't strive for consistent national standards, we could easily have a situation where a handful of states become real chaos. And that could lead to potentially another Florida situation from 2000, for people who remember the Bush v. Gore fight, where you're down to trying to count a handful of ballots and figure out who won. So the scary thing is, and maybe I'll just say this, not to feel superior or special or anything like that, but maybe you want to, you know, like lock in our conversation here and, you know, put that on a good tape, because the conversation we're having right now tells us that we can anticipate the challenges that are ahead. We can have a safe and fair and functional election. And those who stand in the way of it are the ones who must be held to account if this election does not work.
Well, to that point, the Republican National Committee and Trump's reelection campaign are spending $20 million to ensure that people do not have the right to vote from home. RNC Chief of Staff Richard Walters told Politico that the GOP is prepared to sue Democrats, quote, into oblivion by spending whatever is necessary to prevail in these legal fights.
That's absolutely true. There's simply no question that there is a huge initiative on the part of the Republicans to render this circumstance dysfunctional. And there, you know, words fail me almost in talking about this, because it is so rigorously anti-democratic and, frankly, so wrong-headed. The simple fact of the matter is that we can have a safe, fair, and functional election. And, Rose, I'll point out to you that if we have that election, it is possible that the Republicans will do rather well because they have a lot of older voters. The demographic data shows us that voting patterns are such that older voters skew somewhat more to the conservative and Republican side of things. And those are people who aren't going to want to go stand in lines if there's a COVID-19 resurgence. And so the weird part about it is that the Republican National Committee and President Trump and other folks, but certainly Senate Majority Leader McConnell, are literally risking the health and lives of their own supporters. And that's just madness. It is completely wrongheaded. And the final thing I'll say on it is the courts have been pretty miserable on this. And I know why they want to go into the courts. I think I know why they're hoping to get rulings that will make it harder to vote. But the simple reality is that there are two responses to that. Number one, the Democrats have to fight just as hard. And frankly, people who are nonpartisan and simply want to have fair and functional elections have to fight just as hard in the courts. Secondly, it's a lesson that Jesse Jackson taught me a long time ago. He said, you know, we could talk and talk and talk about how messed up our elections are, but we have to be careful to let that become an excuse. At the end of the day, as we get closer to this election, every effort has to be made to educate people about how they can vote by mail, about how they can vote early, about all the options that they have, and every effort has to be made to mobilize folks and to get them to vote, as hard as it may be, because the best way to avoid a chaotic election is to have a decisive election, one where the winner is so clear that the kind of meddling around the edges and the messing with things and the legal fights have less meaning. So twofold. One, yes, fight in the courts and other places, but two, at a certain point, recognize that mobilization and voting itself become the best answer to those who try to prevent you from voting.
Right. Yeah, and we'll definitely do a lot more shows on this in the coming weeks. I also wanted to ask you a question about Joe Biden, who told The Daily Show's Trevor Noah that Trump is going to steal the election, and you rarely hear politicians use that word. I want to ask you, John, since you have really looked at the history of the Democratic Party, what kind of Democrat do you think Joe Biden will be? I mean, in simplistic terms, do you think he'll be a Wall Street Democrat, or do you think he's going to really seize this moment and fight for real progressive change?
Isn't that the great question of the year? You know, and I'm so glad you asked it, Rose. It's one of the reasons I love coming on your show, because it goes to the heart of the matter. This 2020 is not about Donald Trump. 2020 is about Joe Biden. Joe Biden, who now leads in most polls, sometimes by pretty substantial margins, certainly outside the margin of error, who leads in a lot of the battleground states he is going to need to win to take the Electoral College. He's in a very good position here. And there will be those who say, well, he should be super cautious. He should, you know, he should be that center-right, center-left, you know, kind of someplace middle Democrat. And the counsel I would give is twofold. Number one, the Democrats don't need to win by a small margin this year. They need to win a supermajority. They need to really have a big victory, because that's what is necessary to have the governing majorities that allow you to really govern. And you know, again, you reference to FDR for that. You reference to LBJ in 64. That's where you actually get the majorities where you're able to do great big things. And so far, I have not seen Joe Biden as that sort of Democrat, and I think it's very troublesome. I have interviewed Biden. I've been around him in a number of settings. He is a congenial man. He can actually be very likable, etc. But he is inherently cautious, and I think he is also somebody who's learned a lot of wrong lessons in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And as a result, I think he does err toward sort of a pull your punches approach. And if he doesn't overcome that, and the first step in doing so is obviously picking a strong vice presidential candidate, but other steps involve, you know, having a platform that really is visionary and bold, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and frankly just sending a signal that he's going to govern in a different way. If he doesn't overcome that, he may well win, but he will win narrowly. And if Joe Biden wins you know, 49 to 46 or whatever, something like that. He comes into the presidency, but he doesn't have a U.S. Senate. If Mitch McConnell is in charge of the U.S. Senate, Joe Biden will take office as a lame duck president. He will not be able to govern effectively. He will be blocked, and he will have to, you know, bend his agenda to the demands of Mitch McConnell and the Republicans in the Senate. And I will tell you that the Democratic Party will be profoundly damaged. And so for Biden, the real challenge is whether wise counsel can get through to him and explain to him that he can't run this campaign like the campaigns of the past. This is a different moment. You just have never had this moment before where you have a public health crisis that is overwhelming and that has not been met. You have a mass unemployment crisis that is overwhelming and that has not been met. And you also have all of the crises that existed before, some of them coming to a head, a racial justice crisis in this country, you know, the profound failures of state, local, and federal government to, you know, begin to respond to, you know, systemic racism and long-term challenges. A climate crisis that is more real by the minute, the clock ticking faster and faster. And frankly, a crisis of inequality, which has only been expanded by the COVID-19 moment. The fact is, Joe Biden cannot be satisfied simply replacing Donald Trump. I mean, that's not going to be sufficient. To do what has to be done in this moment, he needs those FDR and LBJ-type majorities. At least a Barack Obama 2008. And credit to Obama for putting together a coalition that did, in fact, get a very, very large majority in 08. You know, I cannot begin to tell you how dangerous it is to assume that the politics of the past will be sufficient. It might be sufficient to win a presidential election. It will not be sufficient to govern effectively. And a failure to govern effectively will bite the Republicans right back in.
To your point, John, I just want to mention, I was watching KPIX, one of our local TV stations, last night. They had a piece about deaths of homeless people in Santa Clara County quadrupling since 2000. And then the food banks in the area are just surging. I mean, this is one of the most wealthiest parts of the country.
Well, it's, you know, look, two things I want to emphasize, and I've written a lot about COVID-19 and the political realities of it. Number one, it is something of a lie to say that it hits everyone equally. It doesn't. The fact of the matter is there's plenty of billionaires and millionaires who fled to the Hamptons and are actually, you know, having a pretty good moment. In fact, we've got data now that shows that the you know, the CARES Act and other things like that have actually they haven't created equality in the country. They've actually fed inequality in many ways. And so we need to understand that existing crises are getting worse. But with that said, we also need to understand that, you know, many of the certainties of our contemporary moment are up for grabs. They're very much at risk. And so we have a real challenge as a country. And that challenge is to recognize that systemic interventions were not made at critical points along the way. We failed to step up to the challenges of moments in the past. That's frankly the key underpinning of my book. And this is one of those critical junctures. If we continue on the path that Donald Trump has set, we are going to be in a constant chaos that will ultimately ramp up all of the challenges that we have. If we have a mild response to it, i.e. an attempt to just sort of soften the edges and make things not as bad as they were under Trump, all of the systemic challenges will remain, and the crisis that this country is in will not be addressed. The country will remain incredibly vulnerable to the next crisis. And then finally, there is the alternative, and that is to recognize that things have gone awry, not because of a disease, but because of our lack of preparation for a disease, and also, frankly, because of our lack of response to economic, social, and racial challenges that we have long known about. And so the importance of the 2020 election, and in fact, the fundamental importance of the moment that we are in, is that we have an opportunity. We have an opportunity to go one of three ways. Where Trump has taken us, down a centrist sort of, you know, soft path, or toward the future. And let me emphasize that, that the only way toward the future that is functional or appealing or wise is to address the structural challenges that this country faces, and that is our economic, social, racial, environmental, and frankly, as regards our military-industrial complex. We've got to address them all. I know it's very hard. I know it's challenging to imagine that Joe Biden could do it. But the fact is, it looks like Joe Biden is he certainly is a presumptive Democratic nominee at this point. And so he has to do it. If he doesn't, the long-term damage to this country will be severe. And the likelihood that Republicans will come back in 2022 and 2024 will be great.
What do you think of the task force that was created by Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders? They just released a detailed set of policy recommendations at the very top, combating the climate crisis and pursuing environmental justice. There are a lot of things in here, criminal justice, building a stronger, fairer economy. What are your thoughts on this, John?
I follow the task forces pretty closely, and I was impressed by a lot of the people that were on them. Frankly, they were made up of very, very good people. Unfortunately, my view of the task force reports that have come through, and there's six separate task forces dealing with a variety of different issues, environmental, economic, criminal justice, et cetera, immigration, is that they pulled a lot of punches. And I think the task force reports are going to underpin the party platform, and that is concerning. Because there was a number of places where, frankly, it was important for Biden to signal that he was ready to next step, to go bigger. In a few areas as regards job creation, protection of people in the COVID-19 moment, there's some very good stuff in there, and I'm not going to diminish that. But I will tell you that when we get to doing the systemic stuff, that's where I think it falls short. There is not an endorsement of single-payer Medicare for all health care, which is the logical way out of the crisis. There is not an endorsement of a Green New Deal, which I think is necessary and logical as regards both many of our economic concerns and certainly our environmental concerns. There is not a endorsement of many of the reforms that I think are necessary as regards criminal justice. For instance, this report from the Criminal Justice Task Force does not fully embrace an end to qualified immunity for police officers, which is something that Democrats in Congress have even accepted. And it pulls its punches on a number of criminal justice reforms that I think are really, really needed at this point, and frankly, that I think the American people are ready to go for. It rejects legalization of marijuana. While it favors decriminalization and, frankly, is better on drug war issues than a lot of what the Democrats have done in the past, it doesn't just, you know, kind of dot the I and cross the T and say, yes, and Democrats favor legalization of marijuana. At the federal level, just saying, you know, all across the country, marijuana is going to be legal. We're going to expunge the records. We're going to do all the things that are necessary. It tips its hat to those things, but it doesn't just deliver on the core concept. And so I'm disappointed by the task force reports. I don't think you toss them in the trash and say, oh, it's terrible or something like that. There are many good elements in it. You use those. But I would hope that as the platform drafting committee and, frankly, the convention itself, to the extent that they have a convention, goes forward, that they will recognize a need to be dramatically bolder.
We're going to take a quick break. Today we are speaking with the nation's John Nichols. He's out with a new book, The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party, The Enduring Legacy of Henry Wallace's Anti-Fascist, Anti-Racist Politics. Henry Wallace predicted so much of this 75 years ago, and we'll talk about it after a break. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are speaking with the nation's John Nichols about his new book, The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party, The Enduring Legacy of Henry Wallace's Anti-Fascist, Anti-Racist Politics. If you have a question or a comment for John, what are your thoughts about the fight for the soul of the Democratic Party, where we are today and where we're going? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. 855. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. John, one more question about Trump, because it's so related to your book. You know, at this point, it seems like the hateful rhetoric is really all he has. And I just wonder, at a time when he's using anti-Asian slurs to refer to COVID, which has resulted in an increase in attacks against Asians. We just saw an incident in Monterey this week when he gave his speech on the 4th of July as Indigenous people were being arrested. He talked about manifest destiny, which is basically Indigenous genocide. He also tweeted manifest destiny. And I just wonder, John, how do you think the media should deal with this kind of racist rhetoric in the coming months? Because, you know, people who watch this closely say this is just the beginning. It's going to get really ugly.
Of course, it's going to get really ugly. There's no question of that. I wrote a book a number of years ago titled Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, and it was a look at all the people who are around Trump. And, many of them are gone. They come and go. But the simple reality is that there was a definitional circle of folks, including Stephen Miller and Kellyanne Conway, Steve Bannon, and others, who framed out of politics in 2016 that exploited divisions along lines of race, ethnicity, gender, a host of other, kind of lines where they thought they could pull people apart. This has been at the heart of the Trump experiment from the day he came down that escalator at Trump Tower, wherever he announced his candidacy back in, I think it was June of 2015. So we're 5 years into this thing. They've never changed their playbook. They will ramp it up. It will be very ugly. How the media should cover it? Look, the fact of the matter is they should get comfortable with calling it out for what it is and calling it racist. That is something that they've been dramatically too cautious in doing. It's astounding to me, how still even now they sort of play around it. But they should also be very, very blunt in pointing out that this is a strategy, that this is being done, why this is being done. And I think it's important to do the two parts of it. Number one, to say, yes, what the president's doing is racist, what he's saying is racist. Number two, to say he is doing it for the purpose of dividing us. That the whole point of this is to create a circumstance where he can narrowly win, or I should point out, where he can narrowly prevail, because it's unfair to say it's a win. The president's going to lose the popular vote. I mean, he's looking for a narrow strategy where he could, lose the popular vote, perhaps by 6, 7, 8 million votes, and still prevail because of the Electoral College. And so I don't think you avoid anything. I think you're very blunt about it. I also think that the media should, end the practice of playing Trump's rallies, kind of wall-to-wall, we're giving them over coverage. Just that they shouldn't cover Biden's rallies wall-to-wall and overcover them. You can report on rallies. There's no question of that. But this notion of just, putting it up and kind of stepping away to go have a coffee while the president rants for an hour and a half, or even his opponent rants for an hour and a half, that's not journalism. That really is a failure. And that failure did an immense amount to advance Trump's candidacy in 2016. If they make the same mistake just because it's so dramatic, and it is dramatic, there's no question of that, they really run the risk of, repeating all of the mistakes they've already made. So I hope they don't.
You write in your book, amid all the debate about whether Trump or Trumpism was ushering in homegrown fascism during the first year of the 45th presidency, a social media meme started making the rounds. It purported to quote Henry Wallace, defining an American fascist as, quote, one whose lust for money or power is combined with such an intensity of intolerance toward those of other races, parties, classes, religions, cultures, regions, or nations as to make him ruthless in his use of deceit or violence to attain his ends, end quote. People were wondering if this was a quote from Henry Wallace, and it was. He was warning of homegrown fascists 75 years ago. As you write, Wallace was going to the very heart of the struggle for the soul of the party and the country.
That's exactly right. And, it's fascinating. I've been a student of Wallace for a long time. I've read, as thoroughly as anyone has, his books, his pamphlets, his speeches, the very, very good biographies of him by people like former Senator John Culver of Iowa. And I knew this part of Wallace.
But when Trump became president, I would start to tweet, you know, quotes from Wallace's great essay in 1943, The Danger of, or 1944, The Danger of American Fascism. And I would have people literally say to me, really? A vice president of the United States said that? And I'd say, yeah, he not only said that, he said a lot more. Mm-hmm. And the root of those statements about American fascism go back a year before to the summer of 1943. In fact, we're almost at the anniversary of this remarkable moment. Henry Wallace, as a sitting vice president of the United States, became deeply concerned about race riots. And there's an untold history of World War II, and that is about how divided this country was. The notion that everybody united to fight fascism is true on a surface level. There was a lot of unity, but within that unity, there were great battles domestically about what this country would be and how it would operate. And in a number of cities across this country in 1942, 1943, 1944, you had race riots. They were rooted in the fact that the defense industries had been integrated. They were integrated thanks to the incredible work of A. Philip Randolph and the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters and others. And as you started to see some minimal, tiny movement toward, you know, addressing segregation, addressing racism in this country, there was a real pushback on it, and it was very violent. In Detroit, in the summer of 1943, there was a terrible period of race riots. And overwhelmingly, the people who were killed were African-American, many of them killed by the police in Detroit. Henry Wallace saw this, and as a committed foe of racism, decided that he was going to go to Detroit and give a speech. Now, imagine this, right? You know, you're in a situation of a world war going on and real incredible domestic tension. Vice President of the United States decides he's going to fly right into the thick of that domestic tension and give a speech to an integrated audience of thousands of predominantly auto workers in Detroit. And the speech he gave was, by any measure, a historic speech. He told this crowd, look, we're fighting against fascism in Europe, and we're going to win that fight. But people need to understand that what the Nazis preach as regards, you know, particular groups, is a form of hatred that seeks to divide folks, that seeks to demonize a group of people, using, you know, stereotypes and historical hatreds, all this stuff. And he said, that's the same as racism in America. And if you practice racism here, you're doing what the Nazis do. And he used the term first in that speech, you know, that you are practicing an Americanized fascism. So he identified racism, which was widespread in America, not just in the South, but you know, throughout northern cities, as an Americanized fascism. And that was an incredibly blunt thing to say. He was immediately called out by the New York Times, which, you know, criticized him for, quote-unquote, dividing the war effort. He was criticized by, of course, Southern senators, but also by a lot of Democratic Party strategists. And but he kept right at it. And finally, the New York Times challenged him to explain what he meant by Americanized fascism. And that's why he wrote this essay, which, you know, spelled it out in very blunt terms. There is an argument to be made that this advocacy cost him the vice presidency of the United States, and because Roosevelt was ailing the presidency. But there is never any evidence that Wallace felt sorry for himself or felt that he had done the wrong thing. By all accounts, he believed he was doing what was absolutely necessary.
And I think we mentioned this, but he published that piece, The Danger of American Fascism, in the New York Times. Even, you know, the Times was going after him, as you said, pretty much the same day that he published the story, right? He also said those who sought to divide the U.S. along lines of race, religion, and class could be encountered in Wall Street, Main Street, or Tobacco Road.
And then the next line, I believe, is that they can also, he's heard they can even be found in the Capitol. So right. He was calling out Southern segregationists, but also Northerners who aided and abetted them. You are right. It appeared in the New York Times. It filled a substantial portion of the New York Times magazine on a Sunday. That same day, the New York Times featured an editorial condemning him for saying it. And so it's very, very important to recognize that this advocacy was not embraced or welcomed by elite media, nor was it embraced or welcomed by leaders of the Democratic Party. And a major effort began to remove Wallace from the ticket. It wasn't just because of this. There were many other reasons why, especially conservative forces, didn't like Wallace. He clearly was in a team of rivals. He was, along with Eleanor Roosevelt, Harold Ickes, Francis Perkins, and a few others, holding up, you know, not just a left-wing banner, but really the dream of a New Deal in the post-war era that would be just as aggressive as the New Deal in the pre-war era, and that this post-war New Deal would address racism, sexism, xenophobia, deep inequality. And so this fight for the soul of the Democratic Party played out in the summer of 1944. And I'll cut to the chase. Wallace was denied the nomination, despite the fact that Franklin Roosevelt said that if he had been a delegate to the convention — Roosevelt was deeply involved with the war effort, and he is off in California at the time the convention was held — but despite the fact that Roosevelt said that if he was a delegate to the convention, he would have voted for Wallace, the convention ultimately voted to nominate Harry Truman. I read a lot in the book about the machinations at this convention, not just to recount the past, but also to tell people a little bit about how political parties really pull the strings to make sure that certain people have an opportunity to be nominated and others are denied that. And certainly that happened to Wallace. There was rescheduling of votes and changing of tickets and machinations that, you know, literally make your jaw drop to prevent him from getting the nomination. And the reason they had to do all that was because polling showed — and this is a really important part of it — polling showed that as he spoke out against racism and as he spoke out for the need to really move forward in a progressive and visionary way, he emerged as the most popular choice for vice president. Hmm. And so, you know, it wasn't that he was tossed aside because he was unpopular. He was tossed aside because this was someone who had a clear vision for a progressive future and, frankly, for a progressive Democratic Party.
He also talked about big business on his tour. He told a crowd of 5,000, "Big business must not have such control of Congress and the executive branch as to make it easy for them to write the rules of the post-war game. The big three, big business, big labor, and big agriculture, in the struggle to grab federal power for monopolistic purposes, are certain to come into serious conflict unless they recognize the superior claims of the general welfare of the common man."
That's right. You know, and I mean, there's so many nuances to this and so much complexity. I know we don't have a lot of time, but the fact is that, because you do so much with media, Rose, Wallace had begun a battle with Henry Luce, who was the most powerful publisher of the era, Time, Life, and other publications. Luce was saying that America would win World War II and the post-war era should be the American century, that the U.S. should become the dominant power in the world and basically tell everybody else what to do. Wallace said, no, that's wrong. He says, in the post-war era, it should be the century of the common man, and I would add common woman. And the point of it would be that the United States would be a very economically and politically powerful country, but that it would seek to raise the standards of living and the quality of life globally and be an advocate for freedom. And so Wallace came out against colonialism and imperialism. I write in the book a lot about how much Winston Churchill hated Wallace because of this, because Wallace was talking about, you know, freeing India, freeing other colonies of the European powers in the post-war era. And so, you know, Wallace, this notion of fighting for the common man, common people, was a big part of what Wallace was about. He melded that in with a struggle domestically to address racism, sexism, economic inequality. And, you know, he was talking finally about a vision for government that was not driven by Wall Street, but was driven by a notion of the common good. Wallace was not a socialist. It's an interesting subtlety here. Wallace was he was actually an incredibly successful businessman. He made a fortune after he was vice president. But he was a believer that you had to break up monopolies, and that to the extent that you had competition, that it had to be honest competition, and that never should that competition be a race to the bottom, one that impoverished people for the good of big business or Wall Street. And this subtlety was very well understood by corporate CEOs and the investor class, and they despised Wallace.
To your point about imperialism, just to read a quote from his diary on May 10th, 1945, it looked like the United States was getting ready to embark on an era of power politics and imperialism in international affairs. And here we are, John.
Yeah, it's an incredible thing. And you know, look, there's so many subtleties with Wallace. In reading all of his diaries and reading everything that he tried to work on, he clearly saw the Cold War coming. He, like Franklin Roosevelt, had deep skepticism about the Soviet Union, but he believed that the United States had to figure out ways to cooperate with the Soviet Union, at least to have a non-militarized relationship, one that wasn't all about a hot war. Certainly, he wanted to avoid that, but he also wanted to, frankly, avoid a Cold War. And he believed, again, like FDR did in the latter years of FDR's presidency, and also, frankly, like Wendell Willkie, the 1940 Republican presidential candidate, that the United States could form a relationship with a country that we disagreed with as a country on many economic issues and frankly, had a lot of skepticism about, because it was so vital in the post-war era to avoid new wars and to really try to, to allow countries to have sovereignty, to allow for the development of a new world. And this is fraught with peril. There's all sorts of challenges. But it's important to understand that Wallace was of an era where you were talking about a Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which Eleanor Roosevelt was so involved in. You were talking about, a whole host of initiatives, including the United Nations, that sought to move beyond the conflicts of the past and the divisions of the past. He believed in that to a much greater extent than Harry Truman did. For this, he was accused of being a communist. He was accused of being soft on communism. He was bitterly attacked and ultimately pushed to the fringes, the edges of the Democratic Party, and finally pushed out of it. He ran for president in 1948 very unsuccessfully. And then from there on was really outside of politics and frankly written out of history. But as we revisit that history, we find that choices were made then by the Democratic Party and by many of the elites in this country to go a certain route. And that route led us toward a Red Scare, a Cold War, the delay of necessary responses to economic and social and racial injustice, and frankly, a politics of compromise and concession that I would argue and do argue in the book haunts us to this day. In fact, many of the challenges that we face today could have been addressed. They might not have been resolved, but they could have been addressed 75 years ago, or at least we could have begun the process. And frankly, the party chose not to do it. And I think that had a devastating impact on our politics and on our governance.
Today we're speaking with the nation's John Nichols about his new book, The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party, The Enduring Legacy of Henry Wallace's Anti-Fascist, Anti-Racist Politics. And let's hear from a caller. Hi, Nancy. Thank you so much for holding.
Hi. I just wanted to say one quick thing. My parents were supporters of Henry Wallace, and I went to one of his rallies when I was about 9 years old.
Oh, wow.
And he was wonderful, and my parents were so upset that he didn't win the nomination. Anyways, what I really wanted to talk about was that we really need to forget it. The Democratic Party needs to forget about Trump. What they really need to work on is winning back the Senate and defeating Mitch McConnell, because without McConnell, Trump is just, lost. And they're not putting in enough money, enough support to support Mitch McConnell's opponent, this woman in Kentucky. And they're just, they just always do the wrong thing. And I don't know if you know that Noam Chomsky has written a book on how Trump won the 2020 election. And, he's definitely going to steal it. There's no way that's going to be prevented. But at least if we can get Democrats in the Senate, we've got some leverage, and that's all I've got to say.
Thank you, Nancy, for sharing that story. Don't give up yet on the presidential election. But quickly, John, I just wonder what your thoughts are in Kentucky. We were watching closely as Charles Booker, a 35-year-old black state representative, was at one point actually winning over Amy McGrath. And the Democrats actually put $40 million into her campaign. So there is quite a lot of money there.
There's a lot of money. And frankly, the Democratic establishment in Washington did not want Charles Booker to be the nominee. They really wanted Amy McGrath. She's the type of candidate they like. She's very centrist, very cautious in her approach. And look, we could do a whole show on that Kentucky race. I spent a lot of time covering it and talking to, especially Charles Booker, quite a bit. And here's what I'll say. First off, to Nancy's call, when I do interviews about this book, I have so many people who say, "Yeah, my parents supported him," or older folks who say, "Yeah, I saw him speak," and. You know, they never say, "Oh, and he was horrible." They always say, "This is an incredible figure. I mean, he's been so lost to history, we need to know about him." But it's important to understand that my book also, the first half of the book is about Wallace. Then it extends and follows the course of the party up to the present day. It ends with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And this fight for the soul of the Democratic Party is ongoing. And you saw it playing out in Kentucky. You saw Charles Booker, an African-American 35-year-old state rep from Louisville, saying that the way to win that Senate seat in Kentucky was not by being cautious, not by pulling your punches, but by building a multiracial, multi-ethnic coalition that extended across the state. And it very much drew from traditions of Jesse Jackson's Rainbow Coalition, from many of the other visionary campaigns. And I write about all these efforts throughout the last 75 years to try and build this, what I would argue is a different and better politics focused on economic and social and racial justice. And what Booker did, which was so incredible, was that, yes, he appeared at Black Lives Matter demonstrations in Louisville, and he made that a very central part of his campaign. He didn't avoid things. He stepped into the thick of the struggle. But he also went to eastern Kentucky, and when coal miners were blocking railroad tracks because they had been denied their pay and their retirement, he stood with them as well. And the slogan of his campaign was "From the Hood to the Holler," i.e. from the neighborhoods of Louisville to the so-called hollers, the rural areas of eastern Kentucky. And if you went to his events, to his rallies, people in the crowd in these small towns in eastern Kentucky would yell, "From the Hood," and then somebody else, the whole other crowd, would respond to the holler. And there were people showing up at his rallies in overwhelmingly white communities with signs that said, "No hate in my holler." Mm-hmm. And the fact of the matter is, he was building out a politics of the possible. And so I don't want to discourage anybody from trying to defeat Mitch McConnell. I think it's a great idea. And I understand the struggles that go forward. But I do think that this is an example of a lot of what I write about, is that we have visionary politics in this country. Sometimes it breaks through. When it breaks through, it can really move us, move both the Democratic Party and the country itself in a dramatically more positive direction. Mm-hmm. And we ought to celebrate it. We ought to get excited about it. Now, to the final part of Nancy's call, just to say, I happen to believe that Donald Trump not only can, but probably will be defeated this year. My concern is about the Senate, and I have a cover story coming out, or a big story coming out, in the next issue of The Nation on the Senate, and it parallels a lot of Nancy's concerns there. I think Democrats they're going to want to win the presidency, and I think they have a good chance of doing so, but they have to put tremendous additional energy into the Senate races, and they have to stop running campaigns that are aimed toward a handful of battleground states. They have to grow the map. They have to go back to a 50-state strategy. This is something that Henry Wallace and Franklin Roosevelt not only talked about but did. Remember, in 1940, when Roosevelt and Wallace ran as a ticket, they had an incredibly appealing Republican ticket up against them, led by Wendell Willkie, a very dynamic figure. And yet they won across the country and it ran up incredible numbers all over the U.S. And they didn't do so by pulling their punches or being cautious. They did so with a visionary politics that said it was possible to fight economic inequality at home and to ultimately to defeat fascism abroad.
Yeah. And I should say, John, those amazing stories about Kentucky, Kevin Vance, our studio engineer, just wrote "No Hate in My Holler in My Dad's Hometown of Louisville, Kentucky." He wrote, wow. And just to end, we're almost out of time. I mean, Amy McGrath, with the backing of the Democratic establishment, raised $41 million. And then we have on the other side, I'm just looking for the numbers here, Charles Booker raised about $2 million, most of it at the very end. And the race was so close, John. Amy McGrath, 247,000 votes. Charles Booker, 231,000 votes.
And I got more news for you. It brings everything full circle. You know, Kentucky went down to one polling place per county. And so people in Louisville had to drive across the county to go vote. Had they maintained a sufficient number of polling places, I think it's within the realm of reason, not certain, but within the realm of reason that Booker might have won. And that takes us back to the early conversation that we had here about the November election. You have to look at every aspect of how an election is organized, because the failure to organize free, fair, and functional elections that are safe for everyone really can have impacts on the results of those elections.
John Nichols is a correspondent with The Nation. His new book is The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party, The Enduring Legacy of Henry Wallace's Anti-Fascist, Anti-Racist Politics. Thank you for another great book, John, and thank you for joining us.
It is always such an honor to be with you, Rose. Thank you so much for a great interview.
Thank you. And you can find more about John's work and his new book at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance and Damian Miner for keeping our studio running. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.